because the Republicans control the House, they are going to go after him. They're going to bring in Hunter Biden. Did the Chinese have access to the garage? They'll ignore Trump completely. You know, totally reckless behavior on Trump's part, but they are going to go to town on Joe Biden over this. And there are skeletons in Joe Biden's closet. We all know that. And so this is going to be a really incendiary period for this White House.
Jeremy, we want to ask you to stay with us. We'll do part two after the show at democracynow.org. Jeremy Scahill, senior reporter and correspondent at The Intercept. His latest piece will link to the secrets presidents keep in their garages and luxury resorts, and the war caucus always wins. And the nominations for the Oscars have just been announced. Nominees for Best Foreign Film include Argentina 1985. Visit democracynow.org to see our interview with the director, Santiago Mitre. Also, the nominees for Best Documentary Feature Film are All That Breathes, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, Fire of Love, A House Made of Splinters, and Navalny, about the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Chirina Nadura. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, Chirina Nadura, Tamari Astugio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregonians can call a new hotline for abortion-related advice. A second mass shooting in 2 days rocks California. And in international news, we examine President Biden's border wall policy, what has or hasn't changed since the Trump administration. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 24th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. Oregonians seeking abortions will now have access to a specialized advice hotline for the procedure. The Oregon Department of Justice announced the launch of the hotline on Sunday, which marked the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, which established a constitutional right to an abortion. Roe was overturned last year in the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization ruling. Oregon has been one of many states working since Dobbs to strengthen abortion access. Many other states, like neighboring Idaho, have moved to restrict it. The Oregon Reproductive Rights Hotline, 503-431-6460, will offer guidance for people who need medical treatment and who may not be familiar with Oregon's laws. If callers need legal advice, attorneys staffing the line will provide free recommendations. People who call the hotline should expect to receive a call back within 2 days. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum said, quote, "The hotline will fill an important need in our state for callers to understand the status of our reproductive health laws, including issues related to abortion access. This is especially important because we share a border with Idaho, which has a near-total abortion ban," end quote. Many different law firms are helping to handle hotline calls. The number of people seeking abortions in Oregon increased significantly after Idaho enacted a near-total ban on abortions. Earlier this month, the Idaho Supreme Court upheld the law in a challenge. 48 hours after the Lunar New Year shooting in Monterey Park in California, another mass shooting event claims the lives of at least 7 in Half Moon Bay. The suspect was taken into custody without incident, authorities say. 6 men and 1 woman were killed, all of them farm workers. Some of the victims were Hispanic and some were of Asian descent. Officials say they are working to notify the families of the victims. Half Moon Bay is a rural seaside town between San Francisco and Santa Cruz. The shootings were at 2 locations, one being a plant nursery, the other a mushroom farm where the suspect worked. Authorities say they don't have a motive established yet, but that signs point towards a workplace-related motive. Democrats say House GOP members are endangering the U.S. economy by not raising the debt limit. Four members of the far-right Oath Keepers are convicted of the rare charge of seditious conspiracy, and lawmakers renew efforts to give Washington, D.C. statehood. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
If we delay this, if we have short-term extensions of the national debt, we run the very risk of a recession in this economy.
Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois says tax cuts for America's wealthy were enacted under the Trump administration, and now the GOP needs to pay for them. The Treasury Department initiated so-called extraordinary measures last week after the House refused to act on raising the debt limit. Economists say the U.S. could lose 6 million jobs and nearly $12 trillion in household wealth if lawmakers can't reach a deal.
As President Trump put it, the vice president and enough members of Congress simply needed to summon the courage to act. To help them find that courage, the president called for backup.
January 6 committee member Representative Stephanie Murphy of Florida described the tweet sent by former President Donald Trump, which rallied far-right extremists to the Capitol. Now, four members of the Oath Keepers group have been convicted of seditious conspiracy for plotting to forcefully keep Trump in power. An Arkansas man photographed sitting at former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's desk was also convicted of 8 federal crimes.
Even though the people I represent pay the highest federal taxes per capita in the United States, they don't have equal rights with everyone in the United States.
For more than 3 decades, the District of Columbia's non-voting delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, has championed efforts to grant statehood to the nation's capital. On Monday, Senator Tom Carper of Delaware announced he'll try again. The bill most recently passed the House in 2021, but has not yet passed the Senate.
It took over 187 minutes to make that simple statement. Something wrong with that.
Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi describes how long it took Donald Trump to tell rioters at the Capitol to go home and said the former president engaged in conspiracy to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Lawmakers want to make sure anyone connected to January 6th can never hold public office. Lawmakers in states like Virginia, Connecticut, and New York have proposed legislation to prevent insurrectionists from holding positions of public trust, such as police officers, judges, and even teachers. Representative Maxwell Frost of Florida says the most recent mass shooting in Monterey Park, California, was preventable.
Every time someone dies because of gun violence, it is a policy failure.
Another victim of the shooting has died, putting the death toll at 11. President Biden ordered flags be at half staff at federal sites through sunset Thursday. A new Siena poll released Monday shows 59% of registered voters in New York want Representative George Santos of Long Island to resign. Santos has been assigned to committees in the House, despite having lied about his education, career, and ethnic makeup. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A 4th dead whale has washed up on the Oregon coast this month. While it is unusual, officials at the Seaside Aquarium say it's unlikely that the deaths are related. Number 4 was a gray whale found in a remote area of Cannon Beach, and it's estimated that it was dead for a month before coming ashore. The first dead whale was a gray whale found on January 11th on the central coast near Reedsport. On the 13th, a dead sperm whale washed up at Fort Stevens State Park. Then on the 18th, a dead gray whale beached about 100 yards away from the one on the 13th. Aquarium officials wrote, quote, "When we experience weather patterns like we have in the past few weeks, coupled with strong westerly winds, dead marine mammals that have been floating offshore get pushed onto the beach," end quote. Oregon has the second most unionized Starbucks stores in the U.S., following only New York. That's according to new data from the National Labor Relations Board. Oregon has 23 unionized Starbucks stores, and Washington ranks number 4, with 18 stores. New York has the most in the country with 35 unionized stores. The current Starbucks unionization movement began at a store in Buffalo, New York in 2021. As over 250 other stores around the country have voted to join the union, Starbucks has fought that effort. They've closed down stores that are unionizing and engaged in union busting activities to try to suppress the effort. Workers cite different reasons to join the union, but better working conditions and fair wages are a common theme. A national farm advocacy group is calling on the Federal Trade Commission to investigate price collusion among corporate egg producers. Even in Iowa, the nation's top egg-producing state, egg prices have more than doubled in the last year. They're up sharply nationwide, too, as are corporate farm profits. Mark Moran reports from Des Moines.
A national farmers advocacy group is asking the Federal Trade Commission to investigate the possibility of price collusion between major egg producers. Eggs now average more than $4 a dozen nationally. Iowa reflects that trend, where a dozen eggs cost more than 2.5 times what they did a year ago. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has blamed a deadly avian flu outbreak and supply chain problems for the egg shortage and sharp price hikes. But the rural advocacy group Farm Action contends its research proves those factors are not to blame. Dee Lanninga with Farm Action says her group investigated the USDA's data.
We saw nothing that justified these egg prices, these price hikes. They are up 138% since last year. That's more than double. Meanwhile, companies that haven't reported a single case of avian flu are raking in record profits, reaching as high as 40% in some cases.
In its letter to the FTC, Farm Action calls on Chairperson Lena Khan to investigate, prosecute any violations of antitrust law, and ultimately get the American people their money back. Iowa is the top egg-producing state in the nation, according to United Egg Producers. Some egg producers have said the avian flu outbreak has made it difficult to get new laying hens. Inflation and supply chain issues are also being blamed, but Lanninga says these still don't justify the dramatic price increases.
They blame a supply chain disruption, but we don't actually, when we take a closer look, see any supply chain issue that would justify the price hikes. The avian flu outbreak does not explain it. Average flock sizes in 2022 never dropped more than 6 to 8% from previous year's levels.
So far, the FTC has declined to comment, and the USDA reports that egg prices are down slightly nationwide. For Iowa News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
Labor experts say the pending merger between supermarket giants Kroger and Albertsons could lead to store closures that would hurt small towns and cause anti-consumer, anti-competitive issues. Suzanne Potter reports from California.
The proposed merger between supermarket giants Albertsons and Kroger is raising alarm bells in rural communities worried about the impact on consumers, farmers, and workers. Together, the companies own 734 Albertsons, Safeway, Vons, and Ralph's stores in the state and have indicated that between 100 and 350 could be sold off. Stacy Mitchell with the nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance says consolidation among grocery chains allows them to squeeze more profit on both ends by lowballing farmers and raising prices for customers.
We've seen food production workers and farmers getting paid less. We see consumers paying more for groceries. You've got the middlemen, including the supermarket chains, who are becoming incredibly profitable.
Albertsons and Kroger have assured workers that the new owners of any stores they sell will honor union agreements. But UCLA professor Chris Tilley, an expert in urban planning and economics, says that is no guarantee.
Workers are rightly skeptical of that, particularly because when Albertsons and Safeway merged, they spun off 168 stores, and quite soon, a lot of those stores closed.
Congress recently passed two bills to improve oversight of large mergers. Mitchell says the Merger Filing Fee Modernization Act will allow federal agencies to charge the companies more to review mega transactions so they can hire enough staff to conduct a proper review.
The Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice are woefully underfunded in terms of their antitrust activities. The size of those agencies really has not kept pace with the growth in the economy, and we have a significant monopoly problem.
The new State Antitrust Enforcement Venue Act will help state attorneys general keep the case in their selected courts and prevent large companies from venue shopping to find a judge that the company thinks could be sympathetic. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special episode of Totality of Circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 35. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy but dry with a high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1993, American civil rights lawyer and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall died. Marshall was the first Black Supreme Court justice in the United States and was a prominent civil rights lawyer, leading the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He successfully argued 29 cases in the Supreme Court, including the landmark decision Brown v. Board of Education, which held that segregation in public education was unconstitutional. The quote of the day is from Marshall, who said, quote, "History teaches that grave threats to liberty often come in times of urgency when constitutional rights seem too extravagant to endure." Nation has lifted its COVID-19 mask mandate and elected its first woman speaker in their legislative branch. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation has lifted a longstanding COVID-19 mask mandate. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, early in the pandemic, the reservation was one of the most heavily impacted areas in the country.
Under the order, masks will no longer be required in public indoor spaces throughout all of the reservation's 110 chapters. It makes face coverings optional, except for in schools, nursing homes, and healthcare facilities, and for those who may have COVID or who've been exposed. The mask mandate has been in effect for almost 3 years, and the Navajo Nation is among the last areas in the country to lift its requirement. Navajo President Boo Nigrin says lifting the mandate would help the tribe return to normal business and help boost the economy on the reservation that struggles with unemployment. Former Navajo President Jonathan Nez, who lost re-election to Nigrin in November, has questioned the decision to lift the restrictions. He says the relatively low rate of recent infections on the reservation was mostly due to the mask mandate. He's also calling on the administration to be more transparent with COVID data. At one point in 2020, the Navajo Nation had the highest per capita rate of COVID infections in the country. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Meanwhile, history was made Monday in the Navajo Nation Council, the tribe's legislative branch, as Crystalline Curley was elected Speaker of the Council. This is the first time a Navajo woman will serve as Speaker. Curley is a former Miss Navajo who advocated for elders, has higher education degrees, and says she understands many of the challenges Navajo people face, growing up with no electricity and no running water. After being sworn in, she thanked her fellow delegates.
It's an honor to be serving you as your new speaker, and thank you for mentoring me and giving me advice throughout all these years. I've known some of you for many years.
This is also the first time that there are 9 Navajo women serving on the 24-member council. Additionally, Rochelle Montoya made history this month, taking office as the first woman to serve as vice president of the Navajo Nation. California tribal leaders and state lawmakers will gather at the Capitol in Sacramento on Wednesday night to celebrate Native American Assembly member James Ramos being appointed chair of the Assembly Rules Committee. The recent appointment marks the first time a California Native American will serve as chair of the committee. Ramos became the first California Native American elected to the state legislature in 2018 and was named chair of the Rules Committee last month. He's been a strong advocate for Native American issues, including work to address missing and murdered indigenous people. Ramos was instrumental in the creation of the Feather Alert, a notification tool which was rolled out in January to help law enforcement quickly notify the public about missing Native people. The Rules Committee has primary jurisdiction over matters relating to business of the Assembly. The Rules Chair also serves as chair of the Joint Committee on Projects covering both houses. Ramos held the first meeting as Rules Chair last week. Wednesday's celebration will be live streamed from the Capitol Rotunda. The Cape Cod Times reports former chairman of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, Cedric Cromwell, has been ordered to pay $250,000 in restitution to the tribe, along with an owner of an architecture firm. This follows bribery convictions last year in connection to the Massachusetts tribe's plan to build a resort casino. According to court records, the two men are responsible for legal expenses incurred by the tribe and were ordered to repay jointly. In May, Cromwell and firm owner David DiQuattro were convicted by a federal jury and were sentenced in November. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
It can be tough for Native Americans moving off non-tribal lands in Montana, with some reporting discrimination. That compounds other issues, such as the tight housing market. Eric Tegadoff has more.
Native Americans in Montana face a slew of challenges to finding housing off reservations, including discrimination. A tight housing market in the state and across the country presents its own problems for finding an affordable place to live. But Les Lefthand, with All Nation Youth Partner for Success in Billings, says his last name was a barrier for him and his wife when they were looking for a home. He says eventually they used her maiden name on applications.
When she applied for some of these places, yeah, it's just Leslie Martin. They were more open to that until they saw my name on there. And then that's when the red flags were waved. And, of course, some of them were just outright not willing to talk to us.
Left Hand's organization works to prevent drug use among young people ages 9 to 20. And he says people they work with, as well as friends and family, have similar experiences. Rental costs, like security deposits and first and last month's rent, can be challenges as well. Census data finds more than a quarter of Native Americans live in poverty. Left Hand says young people especially find it hard to move off their reservations because they are not as financially established.
It's frustrating for them, and that's when they give up and go back home and have to live in a tight, cramped household again, because we don't really turn away any of the family members that do come back, and we just accommodate until we can find a better resource or a different avenue.
Analyses on housing issues for Native Americans are scarce, but a study from before the pandemic found 16% of Native Americans reported overcrowding, compared with 2% of the U.S. population as a whole. Left Hand says organizations like the Native American Development Corporation can help people who feel they have been discriminated against or having trouble looking for housing. Most of all, he encourages people to be persistent.
I'm always willing to help people out and try to steer them in the right direction, and then just give them the hope that there is somebody out there that might have an opportunity to open a door, and then they succeed in that area. But then, like I tell them, don't give up so easily.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
It's News Literacy Week, and public polling shows that Americans still have big trust issues with the news media. But Mike Mullen speaks with a journalism professor from Minnesota who says faith can be restored if news consumers are able to help wipe out misinformation from unreliable sources.
Today through Friday is National News Literacy Week. A Minnesota expert says while trust in the media remains low, there's still plenty of reliable sources, and consumers need to know what to follow and what to avoid. According to a recent Gallup poll, less than 30% of Americans have a great deal of trust and confidence in the media. Kay Beckerman is a journalism professor at Minnesota State University Moorhead. She says there's concern that many people are getting most of their news from social media because of those trust issues. She says that doesn't help the problem.
And so they might be looking at something that is not a trustworthy news source. And I think we need to be focusing on really helping people understand what is a legitimate news source.
She says a key way to determine if a news organization is trustworthy is by checking if the reporting often includes multiple perspectives and is not one-sided. Being able to back up a claim posted on social media with evidence is another tool. The website newslit.org offers tips on how to spot misinformation and other red flags. Consumers often cite national outlets when voicing their distrust of the news media. Regionally, Beckerman says outlets around Minnesota often do a good job in holding themselves accountable. She strongly encourages readers, viewers, and listeners to follow the work of local reporters.
The Wall Street Journal is not going to tell me what is happening in downtown Moorhead, Minnesota, for example. But I can look at a local newspaper. I can find out what businesses are doing. We can talk about local politics. We can talk about local events, things that we need to be aware of.
As for news coverage of politics, Beckerman says the classified documents issue surrounding the White House is a good accountability test. She says with both a Democrat and a Republican being swept up in the events, news organizations that treat the matter with the same level of objectivity while also being able to lay out any differences should be viewed as reliable. Beckerman adds that consumers need to realize when a candidate they support is worthy of unflattering coverage. Mike Mullen, Minnesota News Connection.
The Biden administration taking office changed many things from their predecessor, but the policy on the southern border is not one of them. Biden's border war continues, and international policy on asylum still isn't being upheld. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Let's talk about Biden's border war. Keeping non-white people out of the United States was one of Donald Trump's signature objectives. People fleeing poverty and oppression from Mexico, Haiti, and Central America, Middle East people fleeing war in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, Africans seeking a better life, they all became targets of Trump's racist immigration policies. Only ideal whites, he specified Norwegians, were acceptable candidates for U.S. citizenship and entry. As a presidential candidate, Joe Biden came out strongly against Trump's approach, particularly with regard to the Mexico border wall and the harsh conditions that awaited men, women, and especially children who sought refuge in the United States. That changed attitude prompted an extraordinary exodus, not only from Mexico and its drug wars, but also from authoritarian rule in Central America. Biden faced the same problem Trump and other presidents have faced: how to respond to an enormous flow of human beings, 2.8 million in a recent 12-month period, about four times the previous year's total, who seek entry to the U.S. on humanitarian or political grounds. So far, the response has been far from what one would expect from a liberal administration, and it has ignited strong criticism from non-governmental human rights organizations. First of all, Trump's border wall remains, ineffective though it is. Second, international standards for asylum are not being adhered to. Third, the numbers of people seeking entry illegally are staggering and without precedent, according to the New York Times, the highest number since 1960. That has led some Republican governors and one Democratic governor to take outrageous actions, such as rounding up migrant families and busing or flying them to blue states where they might be treated humanely. Years ago, there was an emerging consensus in Washington that if people were allowed into the U.S. for work, they would have the opportunity to gain citizenship after a suitable period of time. It was a sensible idea. Migrant workers essential to farming and other businesses would contribute to the economy, and the taxes they paid would contribute to their social welfare costs. That consensus is long gone, replaced by the right-wing view that migrant workers represent votes for Democrats, a displacement of American workers, a Social Security liability, and even criminal conduct. Those views put any Democrat on the defensive. Now it's Biden's turn, and he seems to be following Trump's path, though without the racist language that accompanied it. In his recent visit to Mexico, he announced that Mexico had agreed to accept up to 30,000 people a month whom the U.S. had expelled. Refugees from Nicaragua, Venezuela, Haiti, and Cuba would not be allowed to request asylum, a violation of international law, which calls for granting asylum to anyone fleeing out of legitimate fear of persecution. Under U.S. law, by the way, those who do not qualify for asylum may still be eligible for what is called withholding of removal because of the likelihood of having been persecuted, or for entry on grounds of fear of being tortured if returned to the home country under the UN Convention on Torture. But it is not clear that people pleading for entry under these categories are actually having their cases heard. Further, the Biden administration is proposing to deny asylum to migrants who have traveled through Mexico without seeking refuge in that country first, a proposal Mexico is vigorously rejecting. That idea, too, is inherited from the Trump era. The president has offered little to Mexico in return, merely promising that the U.S. will be looking at legal pathways to entry for Mexicans and other Latin Americans. President Biden is under pressure from just about every stakeholder: business, human rights groups, liberal Democrats, illiberal Republicans, and the Mexican government, to come up with a solution to the immigration crisis, a crisis made all the more intractable by the drug war in Mexico and the huge influx of drugs to the U.S. from Mexico. Most analysts have argued for years that the central issue is the push factor, not the pull factor. That is, the desperation of people who are typically hungry and victims of violence with nowhere else to go but north. It may often be difficult to distinguish between asylum seekers and economic migrants. Both groups are doing the logical thing, escaping life-threatening conditions. So long as many Latin economies and political systems are dysfunctional and repressive, and poor people are buffeted by COVID and climate change, no walls will be high enough to keep people from trying to get into the United States. placing restrictions on asylum and forcing migrants to stay in Mexico, especially when the U.S. labor market needs workers, not only worsens a terrible situation, it is inhumane. We can and should do better. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 24th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mark Moran, Mike Moen, Eric Tegadoff, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. The podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Sam from Totality of Circumstances here. As we continue to adjust to 2023, we unfortunately need to play a rerun this month, which is, again, our December interview with Portland Cop Watch. Next week, however, January 31st, we're going to play the rest of the interview, which has not yet been broadcast. And that'll be at 5:30 p.m. next Tuesday. And we'll be back for our regular show on February 28th at 5:30 p.m., also right after the KBOO.